from the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for listening. Brian Kilmeade Show. A little different today. This hour, I got some guests that you're very familiar with. We got Andy McCarthy joining us to unwind the Hunter Biden's case. And also the former president of the United States got some good news, real good news on his legal front, not about the New York case, but about a postponement on the Georgia case. And I'll add a little bit more to that. When it comes to the documents case, it looks like Eileen Cannon has postponed another one of those hearings. And I know that must frustrate Jack Smith, who was really intent on arresting and jailing the former president of the United States. There's no doubt in my mind about that. It's been an interesting week as Merrick Garland tried to defend himself. Also, there's no hope really for Hunter Biden to defend himself. As you find out, the eyewitnesses' accounts, what was on the laptop, authenticated, and we'll discuss that too, and I'll take your calls on that, and we'll go into detail on why the prosecution could probably rest today. But first things first, it's been 80 years since D-Day, and for people who don't understand, just picture this. Hitler's Germany, Nazi Germany, was dominating the European continent. It had the United Kingdom, Great Britain on the ropes, threatening an invasion any day. Somehow, some way, they had to get the U.S. involved. We were not budging. But then after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, we were in. We not only declared war on Japan, we declared war on Germany. We joined the Allies. But now the hard part, getting into Europe. We had to have a massive invasion. It had to be led and scripted by General Dwight D. Eisenhower and Omar Bradley. And they would do it. Then they picked June 5th for the day, but it would be the weather was too bad, too rough. They couldn't get ashore. They couldn't storm those five separate beaches. On June 6th was the day, and they did. Thousands would lose their lives. More Germans, though, would lose theirs as paratroopers got behind enemy lines. They'd push their way through, and in a matter of 3 months, Paris would be liberated. There was a very emotional, moving ceremony there. The president was there. Macron, obviously, was the host. You saw Tom Hanks and Steven Spielberg and countless veterans who are in their late 90s, early 100s were there, just over 100. They got awards, flyovers. It's really special. Here's a little of Joe Biden's speech, which is pretty strong. Cut one.
From the sea and sky, nearly 160,000 Allied troops descended on Normandy. Many, to state the obvious, never came home. Many survived that longest day, kept on fighting for months until victory was finally won. And a few, a notable band of brothers, are here with us today. Every soldier who stormed the beach, who dropped by parachute or landed by glider, every sailor who manned the thousands of ships and landing craft, every aviator who destroyed German-controlled airfields, bridges, and railroads, all were backed by other brave Americans.
Keep in mind, too, the president did fine in his speech, and he also used references, and I know some people aren't happy with it. I have no problem with it, to the threat today of Vladimir Putin, who, by the way, for a brief period of time was invited to this speech. I mean, can you believe it? The Soviet Union, yes, they were part of allies, Stalin and his communist aggressive regime that dominated Eastern Europe and dropped an iron curtain, and Winston Churchill would name it, and hold on to it. And they'd hold on to half of Germany for decades. But Vladimir Putin, when he was with Yeltsin, we tried to put him into the family of nations. He wants no part of it, and now he's the greatest threat. People have a problem that the president later referenced Vladimir Putin and the aggression that exists today. I do think it was okay, and I do see the invasion of Ukraine as part of that. People are writing me saying they were offended by it or don't agree with me, and that's fine. You don't have to agree with everything I say, but for once, I fully understand that they took part of Georgia. They'll probably take you. They want to take all of Ukraine, and there's huge pushback. And they've lost about 200,000 to 300,000 soldiers in the meantime, but they're doubling, tripling down because that leadership doesn't care about their people. Hopefully the Russian families do. But on this day, it's just enormous, the success and what the stakes were in that day. People just had 6-8 weeks of training, and they were back, and they were all of a sudden in the fight. These were farmers. These were electricians. These were students lying about their age in order to fight. A big reflection of would we be willing to rally like that again today. But what was it like then? What was it like for FDR and General Dwight D. Eisenhower, who's commanding of the Allied forces? Here's Eisenhower on his speech, June 6, 1944, a man that wrote a speech for if we did not have a successful invasion and if we did. He had both ready to go. both taking responsibility while giving credit to others if we were to win. And we would. It's hard to lose thousands of people and say we won, but we did. General Eisenhower.
Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, you are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you. In company with our brave allies and brothers in arms on other fronts, you will bring about the destruction of the German war machine, the elimination of Nazi tyranny over the oppressed peoples of Europe, and security for ourselves in a free world. Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened. He will fight savagely.
How great is that? Number one, well-delivered. Number two, a sense of power and the gravity of the moment. And that is the message. And, you know, there's this famous thing. I think one of the good movies there was, really surprised, Tom Selleck played Dwight D. Eisenhower. And Eisenhower would walk up to these soldiers before the invasion and basically ask them, are you ready? Are you ready to go? Knowing that probably 80% of them could lose their lives. The people that he was going up to, he was sending into battle, technically sending into death, to their death, and the families and the sorrow for them behind, they'd be leaving behind. So it's just tremendous, the leadership. And Eisenhower was an example, too, of a general that emerged during the war. And for a while, FDR was not happy with the performance of his soldiers, kept rotating out generals until he got to Bradley, until he got to Patton, until he got to Eisenhower, who had to get the respect of the other generals along the way because jealousy was very much a part of it. As the President of the United States, FDR had the world on his shoulders. He took over a country that was suffering from depression. He wanted to bring it out through federal programs, the so-called New Deal. Controversial more today than then, but he had no choice. He had to put money into the system and put people back to work. And then he wanted us to get into this war, not because he wanted people to die or he was bloodthirsty, because he saw the free world at stake. But it wasn't until the bombing of Pearl Harbor where the anti-war activists finally went into the minority. Here is FDR, and this is the longer version, the second-to-last one, Eric, on the sheet. So let's listen.
Almighty God, our sons, pride of our nation, this day have set upon a mighty endeavor, a struggle to preserve our republic, our religion, and our civilization, and to set free a suffering humanity. Lead them straight and true. Give strength to their arms, stoutness to their hearts, steadfastness in their faith. They will need thy blessings. Their road will be long and hard. For the enemy is strong. He may hurl back our forces. Success may not come with rushing speed, but we shall return again and again. And we know that by thy grace and by the righteousness of our cause, our sons will triumph.
It's pretty cool to go back in that time and understand what was at stake. I mean, it's really pure. I mean, World War II, the reason why there's so many movies on it, from Saving Private Ryan to the actual documentaries that we see on a regular basis, they're always on, is because it was so obvious good and evil. No one was like, fascism, is that some upside? You know, it was, you know, Hitler. He seems like a good guy. I think he's just misunderstood. No. Mussolini, the first fascist. Hitler would follow in his wake, and we saw the aggressive Japan trying to take over the Pacific. We knew we had to do. We got bombed. Just really, people want to debate you, we hit back. They've taken over Europe. Put it this way. We watched as the Nazis went through France and marched through Paris and took over our first ally. And we still didn't get in the war. But look at this timeline. You saw what happened on June 6th. That's the D-Day invasion. June 11th, beachheads firmly secured. 326,000 Allied troops have crossed with more than 100,000 tons of military equipment coming right up the back. Now, that's June. August 25th, 1944, Paris liberated. Think about the great work there. The mighty German machine, nothing but success. Finally, they were on their heels. Finally being pushed back by the Soviets, who had lost millions trying to fend off the invasion. And then by 1945, April 30th, 6 months later, Hitler committed suicide in his bunker. The Soviets would hold on to him and find him. And there was all types of mysteries about what happened. But his bunker, I just saw some video yesterday of Winston Churchill walking through the bunker that Hitler committed suicide in. For the longest time, the Soviets said, no, no one's going to get in there. It led to a lot of so-called conspiracy theories. Germany would surrender May 8th, 1945. And then that was just one half of the war. Now it's time to go finish off Japan. So it's unbelievable what was at stake. It's unbelievable how well we fought. And it's very true. I was just at Fort Bragg, which is now Fort Liberty, and the 101st and 82nd Airborne were part of the invasion, and they were going over to commemorate it. And what they were telling me, and I think I might have mentioned on the show before, is that the French are, as much as we are prideful of the way we fought, the French are in awe. You're talking about generations, many of which have passed on. Still, they've passed on the message that they remembered what Nazi occupation was like. They knew about the French resistance on the outside led by Charles de Gaulle, the willingness to push back in, combine with allies, and get your country back. They knew what that was like. And for the Americans, along with the UK, Canadians, and Allied forces, to take those five beaches, go through Normandy, and go through and kick them out of Paris and take the country back, they still remember it, and they go out of their way. They say there are American flags everywhere. And it's really moving because, you know, French for the longest time likes to be critical and look down their nose at us. No pun intended. They absolutely do in many respects. Macron on down says all types of things. Remember, they pulled their ambassador when President Biden decided he was going to sell nuclear submarines to Australia and upend the French deal that stopped them from getting millions of dollars. He pulled their ambassador. And remember the disparaging things he said about Donald Trump. I'm talking about Macron. And evidently, he tells President Biden, please don't let Donald Trump win. But when it comes to D-Day, when it comes to World War II, all bets are off. Everybody's in. They know who the good guys are. And the question is, and we had Jay Johnson, former Homeland Security Secretary for Barack Obama. Could you ever unify again like that for a cause? I say yes. But the one thing is different. The curriculum back then had America as an exceptional nation, emerging power, the great pride, the great melting pot where immigrants choose to come here and want to be a part of our country. And now we seem to be going out of our way to condemn our country, even though in so many ways we've never been better. We have never been greater. I think education would have a lot to do with it. So listen, when we come back, I'll take your calls, 1-866-408-7669, then talk about lawfare with Andy McCarthy and Hunter Biden's case over in Delaware. You are listening to The Brian Kilmeade Show.
Educating, entertaining, enlightening. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Out of the gates and ready to go.
Hey, it's Hutton Withrow. Hot Mike is here on the Outkick Network. We've got your afternoon covered with the latest sports discussion, and it's available wherever you find your audio.
Daily analysis and news. He is hot. I am Mike. Actually, my name is Chad. His name is Jonathan. But you get the picture. We're going to bring it every single day. Whatever you want to call us, we'll respond to. We just want you to respond to what we're dishing out every day.
And while you're here, we hope you're subscribed to the podcast. Like, subscribe, and share.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Well, I'm looking forward to that ticket. I don't know if I'll be on it. People keep saying that in the media. I'm on a short list. I've never seen a short list. No one's ever told me about it.
Have you had discussions with President Trump about it?
I have not. We've never discussed it. And but, you know, Donald Trump's going to make a good choice. He has time to make that choice. And he has a lot of good people to pick from. And I just think we need to win. And I cannot imagine another 4 years with Joe Biden in the White House. Okay. I really can't. I don't know what the country would look like, but it would not be good.
I agree. And if it was Joe Manchin, I know a lot of people listening don't love Joe Manchin, but if it was somebody somewhat balanced, I would be okay. You know, Harold Ford, if he was running, I'd say I prefer Trump, but the country's not going to go wrong with Harold Ford. He understands a strong defense, understands the need. We got to stick up for our allies, understand the need to be fiscally responsible. But it is just going to be dramatically different if a president that can't really do the job now gets 4 more years. So Marco Rubio weighed in, and it's not one of those things where he wants to discuss, because if it looks like he's too eager, that's bad, but it's flattering. It's flattering to think that these guys were going at each other's throats in 2016. They worked also together over the course of 4 years to the point where Rubio is no doubt on a short list. I know Kellyanne Conway's a big proponent. Who else is on that list? J.D. Vance. It also helps J.D. Vance that he set up this Silicon Valley fundraiser, which is huge. It's the who's who of the Silicon Valley. You know, after the 2016 win, they basically turned on Trump. And they were embarrassed that Trump was able to use Facebook and Twitter and help win an election over Hillary Clinton, who was caught flat-footed and unlikable. And now they looked at the economy under Joe Biden, and they don't want any part of it. And even though he'll get the majority of the Silicon Valley votes and the citizens there in the San Francisco, Northern California area, a lot of powerful people see a much more opportunistic economic situation under Trump. So J.D. Vance setting up this fundraiser today in California helps. Senator Tim Scott's a big advocate. They're really good friends. They work well when it comes to racial equality, when it comes to those enterprising zones and opportunity zones. It really works. And also, Senator Tim Scott said sometimes, listen, when the president got himself in trouble with different things that he said, the president's not the slightest bit racist, but sometimes he can be racially insensitive. I enjoyed talking to him. He was always open to that. They are buddies. The guy that's really impressed the most, I think, for someone that didn't really have a relationship with and ran against him is Governor Doug Burgum. He loves that the Doug was a self-made multimillionaire, but he's now a billionaire. He loves the way he ran his state. He loves his knowledge of AI. He loves his knowledge of the digital world. He also loves his knowledge of energy and also knows what it's like to be fiscally responsible in North Dakota, which I know is not as tough as doing it in a major, a more populated state, but still, it's impressive. And their families and the couples get along. Senator Tom Cotton, easily the most talented, smart person in Washington. And when you watch him duel it out on those Sunday shows, he can't be beat. I watched it this weekend with Margaret Brennan. I watched it before with that substitute for Kristen Welker on NBC. His name alludes Peter Alexander. And then I watched him with Stephanopoulos. You can't touch him because he knows the issues and he knows Trump. Byron Donalds was awesome last night defending his statements in Philadelphia in front of a black audience where he talked about how the family, the black family went south after the great revolution of Lyndon B. Johnson. And they thought, why did you say that? He said, because under Jim Crow, the black family was actually tighter. He wasn't supporting Jim Crow. But he was coming out and saying the families were forced to close their ranks in segregated South, especially look out for each other, grow the family. And when there was all these socialistic programs, for some reason, it tended to tear the black family apart. It was never the intention, I don't think. And he also talked about it was the segregationist South Democrats. They were the ones fighting to keep separate but equal. And I knew that the host, I don't even know these hosts on CNN anymore, was pushing back against it. Elise Stefanik, a real fighter, really impressed everybody with the taking on those colleges. So this is the finals. Also including that is HUD Secretary Ben Carson. I know the president's got infinite amount of respect for the brain surgeon who did a great job at HUD. I think he's in the cabinet. I don't think he's in. I think Elise Stefanik is going to have a chance, but I think the finalists are Marco Rubio, Tom Cotton, Byron Donalds, and Burgum. What do you think? 1-866-408-7669. When we come back, I'm going to talk to Andrew McCarthy. He has been following the Hunter trial. There's also some changes in the challenges of lawfare that the former president's facing. And believe it or not, on the plus side, I want him to break that down. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're here.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
The trial is now over. The verdict's been delivered. And now everyone out there is talking about it, including, as you point out, Michael Cohen and Stormy Daniels. And the president, like anyone else, has a right to defend himself in the court of public opinion, especially when he's running for the presidency of the United States. He has to be able to attack the charges, to assert that the witnesses against them weren't telling the truth, and point out all the flaws with the case and some of the rulings by the judge, which are inexplicable. he should be allowed to do that.
Bill Barr weighing in on whether the president could get his wish and lift that gag order so he could start firing back at some of the witnesses against him. As you mentioned, Michael Cohen, Stormy Daniels, just to name two. But personally, I think there's a little bit of a risk there because I know this president tends to say what he thinks, and he still has to not get on the wrong side of a judge who's going to be sentencing him, and there could be jail time. Andrew McCarthy joins us now, Fox News contributor, best-selling author, and as you know, the former assistant U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York. Andy, welcome back.
Brian, great to be with you.
Hey, do you agree with Bill Barr?
I do. I also agree with you, though. Not that you're in not in harmony with what Bill said, but I think the point you just made shows how gratuitous and unnecessary the gag order is. Trump is going to be sentenced by Judge Merchan. Why does Merchan need to have a gag order in place when he's got every ounce of power he could possibly have hanging over Trump at this point? And it's the law of sentencing, not only federally, but in states across the country, that a court in imposing sentence can consider any information about the defendant. So I don't see what the necessity of the gag order is when Trump knows that this is the judge who's going to sentence him just a few weeks from now.
So he's going to sentence him. When you said everything has to be brought in, is he going to sentence him just in relation to this trial and the amount of punishment he feels as though this person, the 77-year-old, should receive? Or is he going to take into the other cases under indictment?
I don't think he needs to take the other cases under indictment. I mean, he may, and he has also said that he's going to take it, or at least it's been suggested in the reporting, that he's planning to take into account the fraud civil case in New York, where the $500 million judgment was issued. The contempt findings in that case and in this case, the E. Jean Carroll civil case in the Southern District of New York, et cetera. He's claimed he's going to take in, or at least the reporting indicates he's going to take all this stuff into account. And that wouldn't be unusual. That's the way sentencing works. But I would just point out, Brian, that the deeper problem here, which is the deceptive nature of this trial. This indictment charged Trump with what in ordinarily would not even be charged in New York because they're like trivial bookkeeping offenses that are ordinarily treated as misdemeanors. And in New York, even serious crime gets pled down to misdemeanors so that Bragg can avoid having prison sentences for criminals who actually deserve to be in prison. So in normal circumstances, this case wouldn't have happened at all, and obviously there wouldn't be a jail sentence. But I want people to understand the prosecution in this case did not pitch the case to Merchan and the jury as a business records case. They opened to the jury saying that this is a case about a conspiracy to steal the 2016 election. That was their story. That's the story they sold to Merchan. That's the way they sold the case. And that's the way Merchan accepted the case. So he's not, in his eyes, or at least the way they're going to tee this up, he's not sentencing Trump for trivial bookkeeping offenses. He's sentencing him for stealing the 2016 election. That's their story.
That's the prosecution story?
Correct.
Which is unbelievable. And in fact, I mentioned that to some people. They didn't know what I was talking about. Just everyday people.
Can I just tell you how they did it? I mean, because there seems to be a lot of confusion about this, right? So we have this hidden crime, right? The bookkeeping crime is a misdemeanor, but it turns into a felony if you can show that he did it to conceal another crime. The other crime that the district attorney finally settled on was another misdemeanor. But in New York, it's a misdemeanor conspiracy to violate the election laws. And the way that statute works is it's a crime to conspire to influence an election by illegal means. What Bragg alleged was that the illegal means essentially were violations of the federal campaign laws that Trump basically buried information by paying for these non-disclosure agreements, and that those should have been deemed campaign contributions that had to be handled under the federal campaign laws. And by that, Bragg's theory, and Bragg has been saying this from the very beginning, and the prosecutors pitched it to the jury this way, that conspiracy was to steal the 2016 election. And in fact, when they summed up to the jury, what the prosecutor argued, Steinglass, was that we'll never know, but it appears that this conspiracy was successful because it may very well be that by buying the silence of these women, Trump deprived Hillary Clinton of being elected president. Because if this information had come out after the their theory was after the Access Hollywood tape, Trump couldn't have taken public revelations like this. It would have destroyed his campaign. Now, I just want to point out that is a preposterous argument.
Yes.
Even on the terms of the district attorney's own case, it came out that the Wall Street Journal, 4 days before the election, leaked the Karen McDougal non-disclosure agreement and the fact that Trump there was an allegation that Trump had this affair with her back in 2006. So the thing that the DA said that Trump couldn't withstand if it happened, it did happen. It had no effect on the campaign.
So they're actually going to say McDougal was tolerable for the American people, but Stormy Daniels wasn't?
That's what they're left with.
Unbelievable.
But the one other thing, Brian, though, that I want to point out, because we've had a lot to say about this district attorney who has no authority to enforce federal law doing just that in this case. I just want to point out that the only real estate in the United States that Alvin Bragg has jurisdiction over is the island of Manhattan. He does not have authority to bring a case on the theory that Trump defrauded the United States, the American people, out of the 2016 election. And in the one place where Bragg actually has legal authority, Manhattan, Hillary won by 80 points. So tell me, how effective was this conspiracy to steal the election?
I hear you. I think it's a joke. And I remember hearing it the first day on the other channels and I haven't heard it since. And I brought it up to other anchors here. And they say they really are trying to say first Russia gave President Trump the election. Now they're saying the lack of knowledge of Stormy Daniels gave him the election. Right. And it took Joe Biden winning in 2020 for anyone on the left to acknowledge that he actually won in 2016, including Hillary Clinton, when he says everyone knows he's an illegitimate president, including Nancy Pelosi, who says that we know the Russians put him in office. But let's move on. A couple of things. Trump had two minor legal wins. In Georgia, an appeals court froze the Fulton County case in which he's accused of leading a conspiracy to overturn the 2020 election. That a court panel will have a hearing on whether Fulton County DA Fani Willis will be disqualified or not. So that goes on delay, which means if I'm to quote you directly, there's not a chance this is going to see the light of day before the election, right?
Yeah, that's right, Brian. And it's really the operation of the same principle that we saw in the federal prosecution in Washington. That is, in the law, you only litigate before one court at a time. So if an appellate court takes the case, that means the trial court can't act on it. So this Judge McAfee in Atlanta, he wanted to continue to rule on all the pretrial motions and do all the other preparatory work to have a trial in that case. But now that the Georgia appellate court has taken jurisdiction of it, McAfee has to stop, just like Judge Chutkan has had to stop in Washington while the Supreme Court works out the immunity claim, which, by the way, we could get today for all I know.
Right. The Supreme Court's looking at that and seeing if there's going to be a limited immunity, total immunity, or no immunity. In Florida, Trump faces federal charges related to the handling of classified documents. The Trump-appointed judge changed the timing of several hearings on key legal issues, according to the New York Times. So this will further delay. Does this prevent that case from seeing light of day? Is there a scenario where this still might be tried before November?
I don't think so, Brian, but I want to push back against a narrative out there that I think is utterly wrong and unfair, which is that Judge Cannon has somehow dragged her feet on this case and now has it like completely suspended without a trial date, etc. What has held up this case is Jack Smith elected. He didn't have to do this. He could have brought this as an obstruction case, and it probably could have gotten to trial by now if he had done that. He insisted on indicting three dozen Espionage Act charges of illegal retention of classified information, which meant there was going to be litigation in this case under the Classified Information Procedures Act about what classified information would be allowed in the case so that the jury can see it. Anybody who's ever been in one of those cases, myself included, can tell you that no matter how hard you try to push those cases to trial, it's very hard to get them to trial because you got to get access to the classified information. The defense has to get access to it. The defense gets to propose other classified information that they want in the case that the government doesn't want to let them put in the case. It's all got to be litigated before the judge prior to the trial to determine what's admissible, and you can appeal pre-trial. So these cases are very hard to get to trial. All Judge Cannon has done here is said, let's try to whip our way through the classified information stuff and the other motions and see where we're at the end of July. So she's got a very ambitious schedule from now until July, and presumably in July she'll set a trial date. But everybody is saying, like, Cannon's trying to push this case off forever. That's not what's going on here. They're actually working. She's worked very hard on this case. So I hate the idea that because Trump appointed this judge who has ruled against him a number of times in connection with this case, that she's unfit and unfair needs to be off the case. And at the same time, they can't give a loud enough standing ovation to Judge Merchan, the Biden 2020 campaign contributor.
So looking to the Hunter case that continues today, the prosecution indicates they could rest today. And I look at this, you know, you have the years of legal experience, but me as an outsider, they want to see that if he lied on the gun form and said he was not addicted or using drugs at the time, the gun store, he checked a box that said no. The gun store owner, Gordon Cleveland, his testimony was he saw Hunter Biden strike the box with an X that said, no, he is not addicted or using drugs. He didn't seem to express any confusion to that question. Now, he's got to get cross-examined, but we have proof that he did drugs. We got his book on tape that he wrote he did drugs. We got the audio tape that says he was doing drugs. And then we got the purchase of the gun, the guy who sold him the gun, say he checked a box and lied. And then we got the gun being thrown into a dumpster and all those things well chronicled, not disputed. So is this case over?
Well, it should be. This is the kind of case that shouldn't have gone to trial. Now, look, if you're a Biden in Wilmington, that's a home game for you. And he's got some hope that he'll get maybe jury nullification. There's a lot of, you know, the Bidens are fairly popular in that place. It's certainly not like Trump having to go to trial in Manhattan. You know, it's the opposite situation. But as far as like a substantive defense to the charges, he really doesn't have one. And the only defense, as I've pointed out, that the only defense he has is the one that Weiss gave him by delaying – Weiss is the special counsel – by delaying any action on this case. This case should have been indicted and finished in 2019. If the guy's name was not Biden, that's how it would have been handled. Instead, Weiss sat on his hands because it was Biden's son. And – in the meantime, while we waited 5 years for charges to be filed, the Supreme Court in 2022 issued an important decision in the Bruin case, changing some basic understandings about how the Second Amendment works with respect to restrictions in federal law on firearms possession. So Hunter's defense, which is given to him by Bruin, shouldn't have this opportunity because he should already have been convicted and sentenced before Bruin ever got announced. But what he wants to argue is that under Bruin, the statute under which he's being prosecuted is unconstitutional. He lost that argument in the district court, but I think right. He's trying to tee it up for appeal after he gets convicted.
Well, we'll see what happens in this case, it seems, and then we look forward to the tax case after, and that's where we find out what these business dealings were, how much he actually owes, and why he thought it was good to make a lot of money and pay no taxes. That's usually not a good combination. Andy, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brian.
Great stuff. And in case you're wondering, we have that whole interview on Skype. Part of the reason we're becoming a TV/radio show. Harvard's faculty has made some real progress when it comes to DEI. But my type of good progress, I'll explain when we come back.
It's Brian Kilmeade. Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. More good news. I think we're kind of coming out of our woke coma and away from the political correctness that's destroying the country and had cancel culture flourish. Harvard University, of all places, announced the Faculty of Arts and Sciences will stop requiring diversity statements for professors that want to get tenure. So for the most part, if you wanted to get tenure, you got to do a bunch of things. But one thing you had to show is in what way that you've displayed in your life a push to help with diversity, equity, and inclusion. Well, it's extremely unpopular with the donors, extremely unpopular with people like Larry Summers, Democrat, who was once president of Harvard University, and now they've dumped it. And they said, listen, if you want to be part of Harvard, you want to be part of a tenure, get on a tenure track, tell me about the service you did to a university. Now, factor this in. Now, I said this on One Nation 3 weeks ago, and I had Ari Fleischer and Will Cain on with me, and they laughed. I said, we've turned the corner. I think that the woke stuff, the cancel culture, the DEI, it's on the backstretch, and we're ready to pass it. I think people are over it. And they laughed. They didn't agree with me, and I'm fine with that. And I booked them, too. I booked these people, and they laugh at me. But now, this is more proof of it. Last week, MIT did the same thing. Does that mean these aren't less liberal universities? Of course not. But it shows you that DEI, this forced inclusion attitude that Pete Hegseth talks about in his book that's still pervasive in places like the Pentagon, which hurts performance, it's got to go. Harvard realized it. When places like that realize it, it means they're getting pressure from donors, which means in the real world, people that actually make the money, finance world, they're done with it. And they're just going to look for performance. We got to go back to a meritocracy. I want the best person. Yeah, you be on the lookout for if you're a minority and you're making your way up and you're going to be the first in your family to go to college and you maybe have two equal people. You know, if you want to give the Cuban refugee a chance because they're basically got the same resume as the middle class guy from Westchester, that could be something you want to do. It's up to you. It's your choice, but it shouldn't be mandated. You shouldn't be eliminated. And the thing is, too, if you're one of those minorities that gets a high position and you know you're in a company that's helping into DEI and affirmative action, people are going to look at you and say, hey, you know, the only reason you got this job is because your heritage, even though it might not be true. Hey, go to BrianKilmeade.com. I want to see you in person. History, Liberty, and Laughs Tour, Indianapolis, Indiana, June 29th. BrianKilmeade.com.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for listening. Hope you're having a fantastic week. It's a fascinating day. This hour, we're going to be joined by Mark Thiessen in a matter of moments. 20 minutes after, we're going to be talking about something else that we ought to be aware of as it relates to China. At 34 after, Shiloh Brooks will be joining us. This guy's going to give you great hope. Executive Director of the James Madison Program at Princeton University. Guess what? He's teaching a course at Princeton. Talks about five great Americans. In the beginning, only 20 people signed up. Now it's one of the most popular courses on that university. He's going to be talking about that, and then we'll take your calls. So let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's big three.
Number three.
Jordan. Yeah. Jordan.
Yeah.
Why'd you come to America?
For a job.
For a job?
Yeah.
You know it's illegal to cross the border like this, right?
Yeah.
You don't care?
Yes, I know.
Yeah, no, I don't care. That's why should you? But don't worry, President Biden's sealing the border. The border battle continues. The Dems are desperate to try and blame Republicans for the epic fail. Why I believe that plan will never fly.
Number two.
The U.S. authorities are seeing if those emails we just talked about are connected to an ongoing Russian disinformation effort.
It is so obviously a Russian operation.
Hunter Biden, this laptop that intelligence officials have warned is likely Russian disinformation.
Yeah, of course, that laptop, Russian disinformation. I know everyone denies they were saying that, but we taped you. Hunter trial looks like a train wreck for the defense as the prosecution set to rest. My takeaway, the FBI confirming 4 years later the laptop is Hunter's and has not been tampered with. Meanwhile, Trump gets good news on his lawfare fight.
Number one.
This is a political attack coming in a political season, and it's not a thing that anyone had been talking about or saying before coming out of these closed-door meetings.
My response to the piece when I read it was, now do Donald Trump.
So this was a classic hit piece.
Really? Classic hit piece, 2024. The Trump team unofficially releases their short list of seven to be the former president's running mate. We look at the list and the race as President Biden is again dealing with the accusations he's not capable of doing the job, let alone getting another 4 years. So also, I'd be remiss if I don't remark that today is 80 years since D-Day, when the Allies invaded France, Normandy, five separate beaches, loss of thousands against Hitler's Germany. They had taken over France. They were dominating the continent. They were fighting against the Soviets. First, they broke their non-aggressive pact and thought, why don't I just take Stalin out? They lost millions in that fight, but were able to withstand it. We come in on the beaches at a great peril, at great risk, and walk away with eventually, in 2 months, taking back Paris and liberating that country, our first ally. How did it sound? Can you imagine this? Landing tens of thousands against Hitler's army, the most formidable force in the modern military world? Here is General Dwight D. Eisenhower, June 6, 1944, cut 9.
The tide has turned. The free men of the world are marching together to victory. I have full confidence in your courage, devotion to duty, and skill in battle. We will accept nothing less than full victory. Good luck. And let us all beseech the blessing of Almighty God upon this great and noble undertaking.
No doubt about it. Great and noble. It would be followed a couple of days with 100,000 more troops, more than 150,000, I should say, would land on five beaches. They'd be joined by many more. And then they gradually, not only that, but they would parachute behind enemy lines. Can you imagine that? And end up crushing Hitler's Germany. And about a year after, he'd be dead in a bunker. Suicide. Mark Thiessen joins us now. Mark, no one has to explain to you the significance of D-Day. What is your takeaway today? Fox and Friends basically had the whole show just about it.
I watched every minute of it. It was such a moving ceremony. Of course, you know, no one can top Ronald Reagan. I think Bill McGurn was terrific on that. I didn't know the story about the stained glass window with the Virgin Mary and the 101st Airborne all around her. That's very cool. I thought Biden's speech was good. You know, no one can live up to the Reagan legacy, so it's very hard to do that. And I like the fact that he connected it to Ukraine. But I was disappointed that he didn't mention Israel. You know, as Ronald Reagan said, these are the boys that plant a hawk. These are the boys who scaled the cliffs. These are also the boys who liberated the camps. You know, this is the war where the Holocaust took place, and we've just had the biggest attack on Jewish innocent Jewish civilians since the Holocaust, and Israel is defending itself against tyranny and aggression just like Ukraine is. Why didn't he mention Israel?
Steven Spielberg was there, of course. He did Band of Brothers, but he also did Schindler's List, so
yes,
that would have been easy to make that transition, but they didn't. But one thing he did do, and I know some people weren't happy with it, but he said, listen, we're in another fight. Vladimir Putin's looking to take back Europe, and he's looking to run over Ukraine. We have to make that stand here. Do you equate the two?
I do 100%. Look, it's the same evil. It's the same evil that launched Soviet communism. It's the same. I mean, I happen to be a religious man, you know, and it's the same evil that launched the Nazi invasion. It's the same evil that's driving Islamic radicalism. And it's interesting how in all of these great ideologies of evil always target the Jews. You know, it was the Soviet Union that put them in the Gulag, and it was Nazi Germany that put them in the camps, and it's Hamas now that's assaulting, you know, killing innocent civilians in their homes. You know, for some reason, the Jews are always targeted. And in Ukraine, you have a country that where you have the first Jewish president of that country. You know, his country is being invaded. So there's a connection between all of that. And, you know, yeah, I mean, we can't allow, you know, the lesson of World War II is we cannot allow borders in Europe to be erased by force. And we have to stand up to tyranny. We have to stand up to tyrants. It's the same evil, just in a different guise.
Just how you mentioned Reagan, so let's hear it. This is Ronald Reagan, 1984, cut five.
225 came here. After 2 days of fighting, only 90 could still bear arms. Behind me is a memorial that symbolizes the Ranger daggers that were thrust into the top of these cliffs. And before me are the men who put them there. These are the boys of Puente Hope. These are the men who took the cliffs. These are the champions who helped free a continent. And these are the heroes who helped end a war.
You know, the whole walk through the graves and his speech. They say that Ronald Reagan was underwater for with the American people on his foreign policy. It catapulted to 50%, and then he'd go on in November of that same year and get 49 states. That's how much this speech meant. People like that unifying moment in our history. So it's pretty significant because, you know what? We were coming off Vietnam. I don't consider Grenada a real military action. We haven't had that military victory. We didn't have the 1993 Persian Gulf War win yet. So I think it helped restore America's sense of worth. And we had Jay Johnson on the couch today, and he says, I'm a little concerned about our education that doesn't point out that we're an exceptional nation. So it's for a Democrat to say that, I'm encouraged that things might change.
So the only two presidents that we've had in which America hasn't been dragged into a new war since that time are Ronald Reagan and Donald Trump. It's just a fact. And the reason is because they were unapologetic about their willingness to use American military strength on the world stage.
Yep.
And deter our adversary. I mean, people, there's this whole, you know, Biden mentioned isolationism today, and he's right in pushing back on isolationism. But there's this myth out there that Trump's some kind of an isolationist. This is the guy who whacked Qasem Soleimani. This is the guy who enforced Obama's red line in Syria, not once but twice when they used chemical weapons against their own people. This is the guy who told the North Koreans that if you keep threatening America, you'll see fire and fury the likes of which the world has never seen. This is not a man who was unafraid to flex American. And by the way, this is the guy who destroyed the ISIS caliphate. You know, he took the gloves off where Obama had been like tying the hands of our troops and they were unable to finish the job. He took the gloves off and destroyed the ISIS caliphate and took out Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the leader of ISIS. This is not isolationism. When we get into trouble is when purported internationalists project weakness on the world stage, and that emboldens dictators around the world. I think it's no coincidence that the reason why Putin invaded Ukraine was right after the Afghan withdrawal. It's no coincidence that's when Iran decided to tell Hamas to go for it. When we project weakness is provocative. Dictators look at whether America is willing to use its military power, and they decide whether or not to test our resolve. Ronald Reagan, the reason why we weren't getting gay, why we all we had to do was Grenada and the Libya assault, was because people were really worried that Ronald Reagan was the dictators of the world were worried about Ronald Reagan and how he'd respond if they provoked us.
Right, and also there was a disaster in '83 with the Beirut bombings. We ended up pulling
and that
out
was
of there.
A lesson that he learned a lesson from. Because we projected weakness there.
Oh, we did, by leaving.
Yes.
And by not providing proper security, those Marines were sitting ducks, lost their lives in their barracks.
Absolutely.
So I want to just get Mark Thiessen. We got the final seven, it looks like, of Donald Trump's running mates. I'll give it to the audience out there. Screened is Marco Rubio, J.D. Vance, Tim Scott, Governor Doug Burgum, Senator Tom Cotton, Congressman Byron Donalds, Elise Stefanik, as well as HUD Secretary Ben Carson. Who's your top three?
Do we know that that's the official list?
It seems to be not denied by the actual camp. But you know,
in
Trump, he'll get up one
day. Not on that list that I'd like to throw in.
Okay, go ahead. Who would you put in?
I think Kim Reynolds, governor of Iowa, would be an outstanding choice.
They don't even talk.
Choice. They ought to. But I mean, you know, again, Trump is not Trump.
Doesn't
you know, Mike Pence endorsed Ted Cruz.
Okay.
You know, I mean, this is not beyond him. And I still think Nikki Haley is the smartest choice. if you want to reunite the party and bring Republicans together. This is going to be, I know everybody's very excited about the polls. They're consistently showing Trump ahead. He's within the margin of error in the national polls, and he's only outside the margin of error in three swing states, which puts him at 269 electoral votes if he wins those three swing states, and the rest is a toss-up. He needs every single vote. He needs Haley voters. Haley voters are going to be the swing voters in this election. They're going to decide who the next president is, and he needs to bring them into the fold.
Scott, a couple of polls. What for our Georgia listeners who are actually going to concern if people that want Trump to win, even if they don't, know that Trump is up by 5 points in the latest head-to-head poll with Joe Biden. If you put in the third-party candidates, the numbers go down, but he still wins by five in terms of popularity in Georgia. That was the state he lost by 0.03. He is up in Nevada substantially. He is up in Arizona. He is dead heat in New Hampshire and in Virginia. And at the very least, it'll make Joe Biden pay and actually put some time into New Hampshire and Virginia. I'm sure they didn't plan on that.
No, I'm sure they didn't. And I bet, by the way, I'm sure they didn't plan to be fighting for a Senate seat in Maryland either. And Trump is not going to, is not likely to win New York, but he's going to compete. He's going to try and compete there and make that tight. And you remember how worried they were about Lee Zeldin and how much effort they had to put into New York. If the polls in New York tighten, that rally he had in the Bronx, I would be very worried about his Democrats, and they're going to have to spend resources there to keep him down.
So when you see that story in the Wall Street Journal and Time magazine about the current president of the United States not being as sharp as he used to be with 45 people interviewed, you see a major pushback among Democrats on that story as if the Wall Street Journal is out to get him. Cut 12.
This is a political attack coming in a political season, and it's not a thing that anyone had been talking about or saying before coming out of these closed-door meetings.
My response to the piece when I read it was, now do Donald Trump.
Presidents use notes in meetings. That's not unusual.
So this was a classic, classic hit piece.
So Willie Geist, Mike Barnicle, weighing in to CNN analysts, your thoughts?
So people think Wall Street Journal, oh, conservative. The news section is not conservative. It's the opinion page. It is a liberal newspaper, just like the New York Times and others. I say that this is a hit piece from the Wall Street Journal is absurd. And, you know, all these people who are like getting angry at the Wall Street Journal for reporting what we all see on a daily basis from Joe Biden. You know, we see how bad he is when he's out for 5 minutes in public after he's rested and has prepared notes and all the rest of it. We don't see him behind closed doors. That was what was so just devastating about the Hur report was that he pulled back the curtain and showed us what he's like in behind closed doors. And it's worse. And all the Wall Street Journal is reporting facts. And they're apoplectic about it because they wanted to dismiss this as a Fox News talking point. And it's not. It's what every American can see on their TV screens every time. And now you have a mainstream news organization right. That has gone out and confirmed it. And they're mad at them instead of being mad that they have a candidate who can't string a sentence together.
We tapped into his history knowledge. We tapped into his political punditry. And we tapped into his personality. Mark Thiessen from the Washington Post, Fox News contributor. Thanks so much, Mark.
Thank you, Brian. Take care.
You got it. 1-866-408-7669. I'll be able to take your calls in a moment. Also, bottom of the hour, a professor you can't wait to hear from. Trust me, Shiloh Brooks, teaching at Princeton. Don't move.
Coming to you on a need-to-know basis, because man, do you need to know. It's Brian Kilmeade. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, welcome back. Just, you know how I feel about TikTok. I'm not thrilled both candidates, Trump and Biden, are on it. I hate it. The Rand Paul goes to bat for it, mainly because his major donor is a Chinese, is the same guy who has the majority of TikTok stock in the U.S. And I think they got to sell it. They got 6 months to sell it. I think it passed legislation. Go do it. Chuck Schumer should be talking about it more. But now we find out why. I don't like the news feed that can manipulate people to the Chinese point of view and against America at a drop of a hat. I think they could also access our personal information. Now a new challenge pops up. It's called Newsbreak. Newsbreak is a free app with roots in China. That is most downloaded app in the United States. Published an alarming piece, for example, about a small town shooting. About Christmas Day tragedy. It strikes Bridgeton, New Jersey. Well, what's wrong with that? How about it didn't happen? And how about it was created by AI? How about the fact that they're just making up stories and bringing it to the local community who are used to trusting their local news? But in a lot of cases, it's no longer affordable to have local news. So now, if you have a Newsbreak app and you think you're staying up with things, hold your horses. It's AI and it's Chinese owned. So if you're Reuters, AP, you should be taking it on, not putting your foot, making sure your stuff isn't put on there. That's the big risk. Now, what's the big deal? If China actually didn't use AI, was doing a job collecting stories, here's the thing. At any moment, they could start your algorithm to make sure nothing positive about Taiwan, all positive in a subtle way, not a thuggish way, about China. Make sure you get the Russian perspective on their invasion in Ukraine. See what Iran was really up to and how bad the U.S. is when it comes to the problems in the Middle East. Do you really want China to own this app? Can't have it. Not just TikTok, this too. So keep your eye on it. I have to say, check everything you read.
The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Welcome back, everybody. Let's change gears for a second and talk to Shiloh Brooks, executive director of the James Madison Program at Princeton. And why? Hold your ears if you don't want to hear good stories about America, especially today when we have the 80th anniversary of D-Day. We led this most prolific invasion to liberate Europe in world history, and we pulled it off, not without great cost. And to put in perspective, it's the Americans that led that fight, that were dragged into that fight to do it. But it's not just World War II, it's Americans in the past. And now, I was fascinated to see a study that just in 2013, when asked, do you think America is great? 85% of people 18 to 24 said yes. That number's dropped to 42%. But yet, the new course offered, relatively new course offered at Princeton by Shiloh Brooks, has been sold out and is oversubscribed. Does that give us hope for the future? Let's ask him. Shiloh, welcome.
Hey, thank you. Thank you for having me on.
First off, your thoughts about D-Day as somebody who can appreciate American history.
I mean, it's an extraordinary day. I've been reading a biography, in fact, of Winston Churchill recently. And to see greatness rise to an occasion like that, I recommend everybody read Andrew Roberts, Churchill's Walking with Destiny. That's an extraordinary man who met an extraordinary challenge of the kind that don't come along too often.
Shiloh, do you believe America is an exceptional nation?
You know, I do. I think America is a special place. America has been very good to me. You know, I came from circumstances that didn't necessitate or foretell that I would end up at Princeton, and here I am. So I think America's exceptional in that way. It's also exceptional in that the Federalist Papers is an extraordinary contribution to the history of political thought. It's one of the greatest books any nation has ever produced. And so in that way, I think America has both a practical exceptionalism and a theoretical exceptionalism.
So we write the Constitution, but now it's time to educate the American people and their separate states about how great it would be for it to pass. And to do that, they write the Federalist Papers to explain to people, various authors, what's coming our way. And what you should be voting on and it would ultimately pass. And those Federalist Papers would go into the history books. And of course, Alexander Hamilton had a lot to do with that. Shiloh, what led to you creating this course and how would you describe the course that's now getting so much attention at Princeton?
You know, I have been captivated by great statesmen ever since I was a young man. I can remember coming home at high school on my lunch hour and watching C-SPAN and watching presidents and foreign leaders give press conferences. And I felt the weight of the issues, even as a young person. And as I grew up, I continued to read deep in the biography and autobiography of great statesmen. And I realized that in their autobiographies, whether it's the autobiography of Theodore Roosevelt, who I know you've done some work on, the autobiography of Grant,
various classical biographies, Plutarch, a great biography of Greek statesmen, I realized that there was a recipe in there for the kind of soul that has to sometimes rise to challenges, and that there was a kind of instruction manual in the words of people of the past. And so I began to read these books and take in these lessons. And I arrived at Princeton and realized that this is a place where there's a lot of ambitious people, a lot of people who want to go on to do great things in politics and great things in business, and that this would be the perfect place to introduce these students to the wisdom of statesmen and leaders of the past who had left that behind, so that we can learn from their lessons the way I was talking about doing with Churchill and his remarks on and his autobiography on my early life. So that's what really got me into it. And I think the students here were looking for somebody to say, these are great people, learn from them, take them into you, make their soul your soul. And so the course really took off, because I think there's a hunger for these things.
It's called The Art of Statesmanship and the Political Life. And at first, when you roll this out, 40 people showed up. Now more than 250 signed up to take the course. And I believe Machiavelli is one of your features. Teddy Roosevelt is another. Sandra Day O'Connor is somebody you feature. And who else is in this course, and how is it structured?
We begin with a great Greek author who was a student of Socrates named Xenophon, and he was a Greek general. He's an extraordinary man because he had both a philosophic education, a deep education in letters and philosophy, but also managed to lead men into war and out of it. And so we begin with him as a person who is both wise in the philosophic sense, but also well-experienced in the nature of politics. From there, we move on to Machiavelli's Prince, which is perhaps the most infamous book on politics ever written, in which Machiavelli says, in order to be a great leader, you must lie, cheat, steal, whatever it takes to get ahead. There is no moral boundary. That's a great disagreement with the ancient world, and certainly with the Christian world, who are counseling a certain sort of virtue. And so I put these two alternatives in front of the students. At that point, I turned to contemporary, or relatively contemporary, more modern statesmen once the theoretical foundations have been laid. And so we look at Theodore Roosevelt, who wrote an extraordinary essay called Promise and Performance, in which he says, if you follow the advice of Machiavelli and you lie and you cheat and you steal, you will never be elected. You will never do right by your people, and you will make this country worse. Machiavelli is wrong, Roosevelt says. And so we studied the life of the man who was really counseling a kind of personal vigor to his readers, a sort of uprightness. He uses the term vigor, the strenuous life. The term manliness occasionally comes up. I think those are terms that students haven't heard that often. And so we look at Roosevelt's advice to young people. We then turn to Sandra Day O'Connor, who herself is a woman of tremendous wit. She grew up on a 250-square-mile ranch on the border of Texas and New Mexico, a woman who was unlikely to get to the Supreme Court, who was one of the first women to go to law school at Stanford, who, when she got out, couldn't get a job and said, well, look, I'll work for free in a prosecutor's office with your secretary, and you don't have to pay me, and I'll just sit in the corner there. And she worked her way from that all the way to being an extraordinary Supreme Court justice. So we look at her story. We look at Frederick Douglass, who I say was not a statesman in the traditional sense of the term. He was a man who was a statesman without a say. He was never elected to public office, and yet he did more to shape the conversation on civil rights in this country than perhaps anybody else. He was a slave. He escaped from slavery and rose to being one of the greatest orators in American history, rivaling perhaps only Abraham Lincoln, with whom he was contemporaries and whom he met. So we look at lives like this and try to show that statesmanship can come in all sorts of different forms, that these people have a lot of stories, and that we should read them and imbibe them.
But there's trouble, because three of those people are Americans, and they are pretty great. Not perfect, but pretty great. And there's been a pushback against highlighting these great Americans. In fact, they took Teddy Roosevelt's statue out from the front of a museum of natural history. You know, there's a lot of people will find something about his background they don't like, whether it was his view on the American Indian on down. I'm stunned by what has happened over the last 10 years. Did you get any pushback from politically correct students who thought, I really don't want to feature or study these people, even though it's an elective course?
You know, I've been impressed. I have not gotten any pushback on any of that. And one of the things that I try to tell the students is that if we are to learn from these people, we've got to take them warts and all. They're not perfect, and neither are you. And there, if you're looking for the perfect person to read about, you're not going to find him anywhere. So we may as well just release class and go home. And so I think the students really are, at least when they're brought around to seeing that these people are not perfect people. Part of the learning process is to take in their flaws, to see that they had real flaws, but that those flaws don't keep them from being great and ought not to stand in the way of us saying there were extraordinary aspects of these people's lives from which we can learn. They are human beings just like we are. I think the students, once they get on board with that, they are very gracious and very charitable to these great people.
I love that the James Madison program was even launched in 2000 at Princeton, and it's there to teach American ideals and institutions. They went and sought you. I guess your reputation preceded you. Evidently, you don't need notes. You don't need PowerPoints. This is all from your heart. You put in obviously, you're passionate about what you do, and the kids enjoy that. Do you think we need more of that at lower levels and not just Ivy League students?
Absolutely, I do. And I see that there's a hunger for that. You know, I talk to high school students, and especially one of the most gratifying things I do is teach a statesmanship seminar in the summer for high school teachers who come from all over the country to learn from me and some of my colleagues about Lincoln, about Roosevelt, about Washington, about Douglas, and take those lessons back to their schools, mostly public school teachers, and incorporate those things into their curriculum. And the response that they get from young people to, you know, who are reading Frederick Douglass's narrative or excerpts from Teddy Roosevelt or Lincoln's great speeches is extraordinary. So I do think we need more of that. And I'm encouraged that there's a movement in high school education and classical education to make that happen.
You know, it's amazing, too. They've, you know, to do Teddy, I did Teddy and Booker T and the President of Freedom Fighter. So that was Frederick Douglass, Abraham Lincoln, their battle for America's soul. You could read every one of Lincoln's speeches, even the so-called unrecorded speech. They've somehow, somebody wrote it down. And you could see how brilliant he was. And you could see also from humble beginnings, 1 year of formal schooling. That should inspire right. people. It's not really who you know. Yeah, it might be helpful if your parents have money. But if they don't, the thing that kids have to know is things can still happen in this country, and it doesn't happen everywhere. And I don't think people understand how good they have it.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, what you point out is true. A lot of these great people, whether it's Frederick Douglass, whether it's Booker T. Washington, whether it's Teddy, in a way, were self-educated. And they were people who were curious by nature and who just sought the truth about the world, who were curious in all sorts of ways, science, politics, literature. And so one can get an education that turns you into something like them just by way of acquainting yourself with great things. Lincoln read Shakespeare, the Bible, studied Euclid's Elements, which is a geometric text from ancient Greece, all on his own. That's the American spirit at work right there.
Absolutely. And I get up to this story today about Stanford University, woke up to "Death to America" scrawled on the side of their building. And if all I have to do is go uptown in New York City, in Columbia, and I could hear kids chant that wearing Palestinian garb. And I'm wondering, really? Death to America at Columbia? You want to kill off a country that's already given you so much. But I want to take a step back and observe it. How do you rid our nation of such ignorance? We don't need cheerleaders. But we could have people that be a little bit more patriotic. And for some reason, it's now in fashion not to be.
Yeah, I'm at the Ivy League, and I see the sorts of things that you're talking about. But I do want to say that the majority of students, and I've got a lot of them. My course had 250 students, and I see a lot of them. The majority of students here are just trying to get an education. And I think we need to remember that the folks we see scrawling the messages on the sides of buildings and occupying buildings, that's a relatively small minority. In my class, I've had any number of students come to me and say, you know, I'm not here for that. That's not what I'm here to do. Let them do what they want to do. I want to come to your office hours and talk about these books. And I've been inspired by that. And so I think it's important for those people, to answer your question, to be courageous. For the students who are at these institutions just to get an education and get ahead and come by it honestly, those folks should be courageous. Those folks should speak up and say, that's not what this is about. That's not what this university is about. We're better than that. We rise higher than that. And so I think that's a problem, is that there's a little bit of an endemic of cowardice. But courage goes a long way, and it's addictive once you start with it. And so my hope is to be able, through my course, to encourage some of those students.
And I have to tell you, by the way, we're talking to Shiloh Brooks, executive director of the James Madison Program at Princeton, a professor there. You know, Professor, we're coming up on 250 years of celebrating the birth of America that changed the world through some extraordinary people who did extraordinary things. And that's why people are still trying to come here. That's still the hope and the opportunity of America. Is there a chance over the next 2 years there could be some type of concerted effort to rediscover how great this country is?
I hope so. I mean, I know there's a number of celebrations for America's 250 in place. We hope to have one here at the James Madison Program. And so I think, I mean, I do see a tide turning. All I can speak from is the vantage point that I look out from. And I'll tell you, at these universities, I understand what the headlines say, but there are so many great kids here who are hungry for the lessons of the American founders, who want to see a different side of the story. And so that's why I've been so successful, I suspect, is that I bring something that's a little bit different. And so my hope is that America's 250 will give us all an occasion to reflect on that, on the founding.
And Professor, do you plan on expanding this program, coming out with another one like this, having other professors do similar types of elective opportunities?
Well, you know, we've got affiliated programs all over the country now that are springing up. You know, one in Florida, there's one coming online in Ohio, one at the University of North Carolina. So we've got a number of places that have taken the James Madison program as their models, public universities around the country. And I talk with those faculty all the time and share my syllabi. And Professor George, who's the director of the James Madison program, shares his views and his insights and his 39 years at Princeton. And so, absolutely, we're trying to spread this message, and especially to the big state universities where they have so many students who are coming in. Let them take these courses. Let them learn civics.
All right. Shiloh Brooks, thanks so much. Appreciate the story. Appreciate your class. And it gives you gave our audience some hope today. Thank you.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
You got it. When we come back, we'll go inside the story that Travis Kelce just told about his visits to the White House. You know, the Super Bowl champion, you get invited every year. Would he go regardless of who the president is? We'll find out when we come back.
Expanding your knowledge base. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
When I walked in, we had about four or five Secret Service members come up to me and tell me, you know, if you go up to that podium, we're authorized to tase you. So like, just when you think you're being slick.
We are authorized. It is completely within our rights.
Yes.
To tase.
It is actually order for us to tase you.
Oh, wow. So it wasn't even like, hey, we might do this. It was like, you're going to. It's going to happen.
It's going to happen if you touch that podium, son.
So that was some of the White House interaction with Travis Kelce and the Kansas City Chiefs went to the White House. This guy's in the news nonstop. I think he's got a TV series going. Someone told me that he's hosting another show. He also just signed a 3-year deal. So he's already in his mid-30s. How much longer can he do this? The outstanding tight end with the Chiefs, who's, according to Pete, is going out with Taylor Swift. Here's more on Travis Kelce, that he's not going to let politics stop a White House visit, which I think is cool because we know the problems that people had going to the White House when Trump was there. Cut 46.
That was a fun one, though, man. Fun one. It's always an honor to go to the White House, man. I kind of mentioned it the last time. Anytime that I get a chance to get recognized by the President of the United States and get to go with my teammates and a group of men and women that I had success with to the point where we get acknowledged, man, I'm doing it every single time, no matter who's up there at the helm, no matter what's going on in this world. I think it's just such a cool opportunity. I think representing the Chiefs up there, I wanted to do that for the Hunt family and all of our coaches that were gone. I wanted to make sure I remembered that and got all those pictures and memories in the bank with them.
Well, the other thing that we now need answered, again, great answer. I'm not sure. I hope it's sincere, because if Trump gets in, you know there's going to be people who are not going to want to go. Other people, like any UFC fighter, would go. And by the way, I'm going to have an interview with Dana White, who talks about this, Donald Trump, the friendship, and how he wants to help out this time, and spoke at the RNC, even though everybody told him not to. I'll have that on Saturday night on One Nation. I'll have the interview, the whole entire interview, coming on our show, too. Just quick note. I'm going to be at the History, Liberty, and Laughs Tour. I want everyone to join me in Indianapolis. You know what's coming up. and it is going to be coming up very soon. We're talking about June 29th, and then it'll be in July, July 27th, Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania. To get on stage, talk about history, just like we were discussing this hour.
News Radio Studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for being here. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. Next week, I'm going to be in Dallas visiting all the listeners from KLIF. It's going to be great. Hope you can join me Tuesday night. We're going to be finding a place to do Fox and Friends in Dallas on Wednesday. We'll be posting that up, so hope to see you in person. We're just thrilled to be on in Dallas. Just come on in Richmond, and we have another big announcement coming, too. We're adding these great markets, getting to meet some great people. This hour, I'm going to be joined by Alexi Lalas and Stu Holden, Fox Sports soccer analyst, best in the business. They got two huge tournaments. Got the Copa Cup, Copa America Cup this summer coming up in June. And right before that, the UEFA Cup. We're going to talk about the best teams in Europe. It's often the best competition. Certainly, the most. You'll probably know. If you're just getting into soccer, just know Cristiano Ronaldo is going to be playing there in Europe. And then you got this guy named Messi, who also stars in the MLS, helping us out locally. And the U.S. is hosting this year. So Julian Epstein is standing by. We're going to get a chance to see him in person. And we got news about the Gilgo Killer. This might be the worst serial killer maybe in American history. When it's all said and done, they continue to find more bodies, and it's in my town of Massapequa. So embarrassing. Let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
Jordan. Yeah. Jordan. Yeah. Why'd you come to America?
For a job.
For a job?
Yeah.
You know it's illegal to cross the border like this, right?
Yeah.
You don't care?
Yes, I'm okay.
Yeah, he does not care. That is Bill Malusian doing great work, telling people why, asking people, why are you crossing into San Diego with migrants crossing the border unfazed by Biden's border executive action? The border battle continues. Dems are trying to blame Republicans for walking away from the legislation. They said it wouldn't have worked. And Donald Trump weighs in.
Number two.
The U.S. authorities are seeing if those emails we just talked about are connected to an ongoing Russian disinformation effort.
It is so obviously a Russian operation.
Hunter Biden, this laptop that intelligence officials have warned is likely Russian disinformation.
Remember that? That is a flashback to just 4 years ago. The Hunter Biden trial looks like a train wreck for the defense, as the prosecution is set to rest already. My takeaway, the FBI confirming 4 years later, the laptop of Hunter's is real. In fact, it has not been tampered with. Who said that? The FBI. The same people that told us, sat on it, didn't tell anybody, did not verify that it was real. 50 intel experts told it was fake news, and now got confirmed what we knew all the time. That has a lot of international business deals with the Bidens, especially Hunter, along with pictures of his drug use.
Number one.
This is a political attack coming in a political season, and it's not a thing that anyone had been talking about or saying before coming out of these closed-door meetings.
My response to the piece when I read it was, now do Donald Trump.
So this was a classic, classic hit piece.
Yeah, you could do Donald Trump. I'm talking about the Wall Street Journal story that talked about interviewing 45 people, and they think that behind closed doors, things are bad for Joe Biden. Needs cards for everything. Falls asleep at meetings. Can't hold the same thought. Does not project himself. He's basically oftentimes at a mumble. Some good days, but some bad days. 45 people, and they say, hit job. Joining us now is Julian Epstein, served as counsel to the House Judiciary Committee and staff director to the House Oversight Committee. And he's joining us in studio via Skype. So you can go on the app, hit watch, just page over until you get us. And you got Julian wearing an Adidas cap. Hey, Julian, thanks for dressing up for me.
Hey, good morning, Brian.
I like the casual look. Good job. Yeah. First off, do you look at the Wall Street Journal editorial as a hit job or good journalism or somewhere in between?
I think it's very strong, and I think it's what a lot of people know. It's an investigative story where they interviewed 45 people from both parties, and they recounted what I think are some disturbing facts. The president sort of wanders and meanders around in meetings, has trouble remembering conversations, has trouble remembering world leaders, has trouble sort of just with the basic command of everyday activities. And you sort of have to ask yourself this question. The world is a very dangerous place right now. Look at what's happening in the Middle East. Israel is under attack, not just by Hamas, but on six different fronts. And the president seems to be inconsistent in what he says about what Israel ought to be doing to respond. Look at what's happening in the Red Sea. Look at what's happening in China. Look at what's happening in Ukraine. Look at Iran, Russia, and China all having greater influence in South America right now, in Africa. I mean, the world is a dangerous place. And if you, you know, one of the pieces the investigators found was the president is unaware that Africa has now exceeded 1 billion people. And so the question is, if you have, if you're unable to kind of, you know, just grasp the basic facts, how can you make important decisions? And that's the question that the American people are asking. I am on record saying that I don't think Biden should be running for a second term, regardless of what you think about his accomplishments in his first term or before that. And, you know, I heard someone on TV ask the question, Brian, which I think is a question that the Republicans are going to put to Democrats, which is, would you feel comfortable with Joe Biden driving you to the grocery store? And if the answer to that is no, then I think the Democrats have a problem here. You know, it's not too late to find a substitute candidate. You still can do that up into the convention.
Right.
But I think this is going to be a major issue. And I think this is going to be a bigger issue than Trump's conviction. And I think Democrats have put their head in the sand on this. Whatever you think about Joe Biden, I think if you just, the White House admits this fact by the mere virtue of the fact that they will not put him at a press conference, they will not put him in an adversarial setting where he has to answer difficult questions.
He's going to talk to David Muir today on ABC. I don't know. Sometimes he asks tough questions. I don't know him too well.
They go softball, but remember, David Muir, there's going to be a limited time interview. They'll ask him sort of big picture.
Julian, believe me, I agree with you. I get it. But I want to bring something else up. That Robert Hur report, I read the transcript, and I don't even need to hear the tapes. The transcript is all over the place. They said, sir, that's nice and would be interesting, but my question was, they do this constantly throughout the transcript, and he chose to do it on October 7th, the day that Israel was hit. My goodness, Robert Hur said, I was shocked he still wanted to meet with me. And they do the interview for like 6 hours or whatever it was. And I'm saying, man, this matters a lot. Robert Hur's trying to find out why your house was filled with top secret documents over the course of decades, things that dated back prior to the end of the Cold War. And something that I think mattered a lot, he could not keep a line of thought to the point where at the end they concluded, we're not going to prosecute this guy. Not that he's not guilty, but that he's going to be sympathetic because he's old. He does not hold this thought and his faulty memory. I mean, that's interesting if he's out of office, let alone the fact he wants 4 more years in office. That's why the Republicans are pursuing to try to get the transcript to show everyone this guy shouldn't be the nominee, let alone be the next president. But it's not up to Republicans. It's up to Democrats. Julian, if Joe Biden was to step aside right now, who would Julian Epstein like to see run?
For the Democrats, I think the Democrats have gone far too left on economic issues, and I think they've gone far too left on cultural issues, immigration, crime, critical race theory, critical gender theory. I would like to see the Democrats go back to where they were during the Bill Clinton presidency, which is a centrist, pro-business, socially moderate, economically moderate party. That's the party the Democratic Party used to be that I was part of, and now the party has gone to, in my view, the extreme left.
But who's out there?
I would like to see, if it were Joe Manchin, who was my number one choice, he's moved to an independent, to be an independent now, as you know, Brian. The guy that I would like to see is Josh Shapiro. He's a very moderate governor from Pennsylvania. He's very pro-Israel. He doesn't go along with a lot of the far left critical theories on social policy. He challenges the teachers unions on issues like school choice and charter schools, which is an important bridge the Democratic Party has got to cross if they want to solve what I think is one of the most pressing social issues we have, which is the failing public schools. And the success of charter schools has been remarkable. Josh Shapiro is a guy who's not scared to challenge left-wing orthodoxies. And that's the kind of guy I think that we need to see. And if you look at why so many people are leaving the party, Brian, if you look at working-class blacks, working-class browns, so many people are starting to leave the party, it's because they feel the party's gone too far left. So until somebody challenges the orthodoxies of what I call the intersectional left that have done that have captured social media and intimidated people from speaking out and moving to, more towards a centrist position, until you have somebody that's willing to do that, I think the party's going to have problems.
Right, right. I want you to hear what Senator John Fetterman said on CNN yesterday, Cut 42.
I was very clear for saying that for years I'm not a progressive, and I just identified myself as just a regular Democrat. So it really wasn't any new news. Now, 8 years ago, I was a progressive, but the situation's changed, and I've been very clear that I didn't leave that label. That label left me, and I think it's much more important to be focusing on Donald Trump instead of, you know, kinds of purity tests and those kinds of issues.
Yeah, and I think people are really concerned that they're destroying the whole economy for a green economy where you can be environmentally conscious but also be economically savvy and understand 100%. That upping people's utility bills is not a way to win them over, and it's not helping the earth get to become a better place. It's got to be a responsible way to do it. And that's what I find so scary, that if Joe Biden gets another 4 years, is that if you're not happy, the people on the left think he's not left enough. And can you imagine what he's going to be like as he continues to take his hands off the wheel and let his 24-year-old staff run things? Final thought?
Well, I speak to Democrats about this all the time. They lament the fact that the intersectional left, the far left, has overtaken the party. They have hijacked the party. The far progressive left represents about 6% of voters in this country. And if you want to know why Biden is underwater in double digits on almost every issue, whether it is immigration, economy, all of the social issues, even foreign affairs, it is because the far left has commandeered policymaking under the Biden administration, and they haven't had the guts to say no to them and to say we're going to tack towards the political center where majority of the voters are.
Majority of the voters, right.
60-70% of voters are moderate or conservative in this country.
I lied. I have one more topic for you. This is 50 Cent leaving Capitol Hill yesterday after testifying. As you know, he spent times in prison, has been shot multiple times. But he is a very successful entrepreneur, seems to really have his head together right now. And this is what he said, Cut 44.
What message do you think he is as African-American men in this election? Both of you.
I see them identifying with Trump.
Why do you say that?
Because they got RICO charges.
So, you know, they asked him, what are African-American looking for this year? And he said, I see them identifying with Trump, especially with those charges. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, well, it's that's part of it. It's also the idiocy, I think, of the far left. They have and issues like defund the police. What they have not understood is that black voters tend, for the most part, to be very moderate voters. And many of them, particularly working class black voters, are conservative voters. And so when you look at, I think, the unfairness of what has happened in the Trump trial in Manhattan, which I think was a gross abuse of the system, or you look at any host of other issues, critical race theory, critical gender theory, how the economy has not performed for working class people in the past 4 years, you can see why you see as much as 25-30% of black men may go voting for Trump. And the same thing is happening with Hispanic. Same thing is happening in the Asian community. You're seeing a bleeding, particularly of working class voters who are asking to return to a more common sense centrist approach. But the Democrats can't do it because they are captured by the far intersectional left that has, again, learned to how to shame politicians and other folks for speaking out against far left orthodoxies. And this is the central problem facing the Democratic Party that they have not grappled with.
And we'll see right now. They're very tight in all these races, but in most battleground states is Trump winning. He's also in a dead heat in New Hampshire and Virginia. He's up in double digits in Nevada. And in Georgia, I think he's up 4. Even with RFK in the race, he has less percentage, but he's still up 4 or 5. So let's see what's going to change. They're going to try to make Donald Trump the worst person on earth. That's what Barack Obama did to Mitt Romney, and he won.
But that's the problem. But that's the problem, Brian. Going out and saying, the Democrats have said that Trump is an evil person, Trump is an evil person. They've said that for 8 years now. So all they're taking to the campaign trail this time is that and abortion. And if Democrats can't sell to the public something more substantive on the economy and on the other issues we spoke about, then I think the party's going to be in real trouble.
All right. You're not in real trouble, Julian. Thanks for your honesty, candor, and legal expertise. Julian Epstein, thanks.
All right. Thanks for having me again, Brian.
Yeah, no problem. When we come back, we have a lot more to discuss. And at the bottom of the hour, we talk about the world's most popular game, soccer, international soccer, and what Fox Sports is doing, bringing it to you all summer long with the Copa Cup as well as UEFA Cup. So this is the Brian Kilmeade Show. Don't move.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. This guy is really embarrassing. You know, Massapequa's got a lot of interesting things to be proud of. You know, you got the Baldwins. They've had good days and bad days, but they're certainly famous. The Baldingers, they had three brothers playing in the NFL at the same time. One played against in the Super Bowl against each other. They got Jerry Seinfeld, who enough said. And then you have Brian Setzer, founder of the Stray Cats, Brian Setzer Orchestra. You have the rhythm guitarist from the Cars. You have Steve Guttenberg. But you also have Rex Uhrman, who is now a prolific serial killer. This guy, who's an architect, lived in a ramshackled house. It's a small house that was falling apart. Why would an architect be in a house that's falling apart while working in Manhattan? That's part of his insanity. Meanwhile, he was getting prostitutes and basically killing prostitutes. Today in a press conference that should be happening any moment, they're going to announce they put together, pinned another murder on him. I think they're up to five. Soon it's going to be up to six. They find out that there's things in their walls. They've been taking apart the floorboards, been digging in the backyard. This guy had a way of covering his tracks. He was also obsessed with the Gilgo murders. This guy is the Gilgo serial killer. So as bad as it is, and you think it's bad with four dead girls, how about now we're up to fifth and sixth murder charge against him. And I was watching the DA today. He did an interview last night on local News 12. And he says when it's all said and done, he'll be one of the most prolific serial killers in our history. That means there's many more than six. Out of nowhere, they shut down the block again. This is a bedroom community where everyone's got a sidewalk in front of their house. Houses are pretty much on 60 by 100 or 80 by 100 or 40 by 100. So they're right next to each other. Everybody knew this guy was some type of a knucklehead. We didn't know he was a killer. But again, the whole neighborhood gets disrupted. Everybody comes by to gawk. And right around the block or a few blocks away is Jonathan Diller's widow. Jonathan Diller, the officer that was killed in Queens, New York, when he walked up to find out that this guy was actually casing a store, and he was, and he didn't want to be caught because he's been in jail before, so he shot Jonathan Diller dead. So there's a lot going on in that town, and we'll continue to follow up on it. Meanwhile, today is 80 years since D-Day, pretty moving ceremony this morning. We covered it through Fox and Friends, and we have some sound bites. We'll be playing in the final half hour a little bit. And in fact, you have Joe Biden get a solid speech, at which time he equated Vladimir Putin really to Hitler and says, we've got to push back on aggression. The one thing that I would amend, I'm all for doing everything you can to win in Ukraine, but you can't do it the way Joe Biden's doing it. Next, when people say Hitler and Putin, put them in the same sentence and they think that's wrong, no, they're not wrong. It's the same mindset. They've already taken portions of Georgia. They're trying to take Ukraine. They're moving in on the Baltics and trying to take Moldova. What more proof do you need? As well as spreading out through Africa and even parts of Venezuela. That's proof enough. What we have to do is get countries like France, get countries like Germany to get up to 2% of their defense spending.
Information you want. Truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, we are back. And with me in studio, if you're smart enough to have gotten the Fox Nation app, if you're smart enough to watch it on your iPhone, you can click on watch and just go over. We have in studio Alexi Lawless and Stu Holden, Fox Sports analyst extraordinaire, to announce two special tournaments. What are we now? A year out of the World Cup. Oh, is it 2 years?
2 years.
Two years. But guys, thanks a lot. On radio, it's hard to get people to dress up like this.
Hey,
you
listen,
have responded to the challenge.
For you. And then my good young friend Stu Holden over here, for those that are just listening here, he looks phenomenal. The amount of compliments we have gotten just in the few hours that we have been
up
here. It's insane. People all love that. It's great.
Yeah, see, Brian, I'm smart. I stand next to Alexi, so I actually look good. You know?
What color is that, Stu?
It's like a, you know, a reddish salmon, I guess we could go with.
Rose, yeah. You had a little rose in there. You know?
But you matched Alexi's tie.
Yeah, it's. Yeah, I mean, I always do the pink tie and everything. Stu loves his tight pants and his cool guy tennis shoe look. That's right. You know, that everybody does. And I'm an old school, you know, actual dress shoes and stuff like that. And, you know, fitting pants, but not the.
You look good, buddy.
Your pants at times are almost like shorts, you know?
So let me ask you, as a soccer player, now that you're more of an adolescent player, did you lose quad size?
I lost a little bit of quad size, but the legs have remained. When I was growing up, my father would call me Nubs. That was his nickname for me. It stood for no upper body strength.
Is that true?
That's true. 100% true. And still to this day, you know, whenever I come around the corner, I'm like, hey, Nubs, whatever. So, but I made up for it in terms of the power
in
my body. And that's maintained.
Yeah, I got a good story quickly. We were in New York covering a game. U.S. men's national team were playing it at MetLife. And Lexi and I came in a day early, and I said, hey, one of my buddies here is a trainer. Like, let's go do a workout. So we quickly go to this workout. I mean, this guy was throwing kettlebells and ropes and, you know, dumbbells, squats, all this stuff he'd never done before. The next day, he couldn't even get off the toilet. He texts me, goes, I'm stuck. Yeah. Lexi, he's like, I've never felt so sore in my life. He goes, I don't lift weights. He was sore. You were sore for a week.
It was brutal. I know, but I couldn't let it go. I couldn't, you know, be a wuss about it. And so I went and did it. But it was brutal. You know, you're looking, though, at two former athletes who are bionic at this point. We have both had knee replacements. And we are better for it. I don't want to speak for you, but we are better for it.
Can you run still?
I can now, yeah. 38, I've had a knee replacement. I think I was the youngest patient my doctor had. It beats you up.
You did have injuries.
I had four ACLs. Fractured my left knee. I've had 14 knee surgeries, including now the replacement.
And you have one new knee?
Yeah, I got one new knee, and it's fine.
Wear and tear?
Just wear and tear.
Was it constant pain?
Yeah, I wish I had done it sooner. So and you start to compensate and do all that. And they get you right up. I know people that have had this are nodding their heads. They get you right up and going and everything. And, you know, it's a...
And did you want to be coddled?
I wanted a couple days maybe.
Yeah. But no.
But my wife and kids, there was none of that. Yeah. It was, you know, pop another pill and off you go.
All right. So there's two tournaments coming up this summer. Are you, by the way, are you going to the events? Are you going to go
to
Europe?
Do your thing, Stu. All right. I will be in Los Angeles in the studio. But Stu Holden, my friend,
is going to get schedule.
some frequent flyers.
We start the UEFA Euro on June 14th, and that's going to kick off our coverage. We've got all our commentators on site over in Germany. And then look,
because you don't really need them. They show that during the pandemic. I prefer the commentators there. But do you notice that most people didn't know that you guys weren't there?
Yeah, well, they and that's the thing, actually. Sometimes, you know, you do some different games not at stadiums. But big events, we're in the stadium. And I'm going to be at every game. So here's my schedule. It's Lexi Loves Me reciting. I'm starting June 20th in Atlanta for Argentina against Canada to kick us off. I go to Houston, Dallas, Dallas to New York, New York to Atlanta, Atlanta to Miami, Miami to Kansas City, Kansas City, Phoenix, Phoenix to Vegas, Vegas to Charlotte, Charlotte to New York, New York to Miami.
Wow. And those are two cups combined.
That's only Copa, what I'll be doing at that. But I'll be in stadium, and, you know, this is Argentina. It's Brazil. It's Messi. It's the United States. And my first U.S. game is against Bolivia in Dallas, and then the U.S. play in Atlanta after that.
But it's another summer of soccer.
Summer of soccer,
like we said, from the moment you get up until the moment you go to sleep, and hopefully you stay up late, we got you covered. So you get your breakfast and your lunch, maybe a little bit of dinner when it comes to the European Championships, which are happening over in Germany, which we're broadcasting. And then we're going to segue right into the Copa America, which is happening right here in the United States, into your afternoon, your happy hour, and then obviously into the evening and dinner.
So you picked the right network. I mean, Fox.
Absolutely.
Were you hesitant at all coming over?
So I worked at ESPN for a number of years, and it was wonderful, but it's a very, very different type of environment. I wasn't hesitant in that.
They showed you the commitment to the sport.
They bought the rights to the World Cup, and so I wanted to be where the World Cup is and has been now for multiple cycles, and who knows, maybe in the future will continue to be, and obviously 2026 is a big part of the conversation that's going on. The people were just incredible. I'm very proud of the work that I've done before, but what we have done in terms of propelling the game, if I can say so, I have incredible pride. All the men and women behind the camera that have made us look good. Believe me, it takes a village when it comes to what we're doing. But it's a fun place to be when it comes to soccer, especially when we do these big tournaments.
Isn't that the Eric Shanks who runs a place?
You know, like,
what do I need to make you happier? Because then if you're happier, you're going to be better.
Yep.
And yeah. feel supported.
Absolutely.
Rather than sit in judgment. That's pretty much the philosophy of Fox News, too.
Yeah. Well, there are a lot of happy people there and a lot of people that work their asses off each and every time to put this together. And I think this summer is going to be really interesting. And like I said, you know, it's a precedent-setting type of thing where you have two tournaments happening at the same time, right, overlapping on the same network. So we got you covered from morning till night.
You know, what's interesting for me is you could break down any game. I could put a game in front of you guys. You could tell me exactly what's happening, what lineup works, and how the adjustments you'd make. Right or wrong, it would be an educated guess. But to know the names and the style of play.
That's more my job as a commentator in games. And I tell you, I do feel it is one of our greatest responsibilities to get somebody's name right. I mean, it sounds easy, right?
But I don't think it's
very challenging sometimes when you're dealing with, you know, let's talk about, you know, some of the Middle Eastern countries and the Korean team at times is very difficult. Like I think there's six or seven players with the last name Kim. So you have to say their full name every single time to be able to distinguish the different players. And it's our job to get that right because, you know, these are the players that have earned that right to be on that stage.
But how do you do it with headshots or do you do it by watching them practice?
Watching games. Yeah, you watch a lot of games and you become familiar. The biggest grace saver for a commentator is the number on the back of the jersey. And it's my biggest pet peeve when a team will have a jersey with a number that is very similar to the back of the jersey and you're kind of trying to squint and make sure that you have the right guy because misidentifying a player is a big part of it, especially if it's a big moment and it's our job to really pay that off for them.
Just so people at home understand too, if a lot of people, non-soccer players are now watching, which I never thought would happen in my lifetime. Usually soccer players try to get them passionate about being viewers. I never thought that just sports fans who never touched a soccer ball are now so into it. But it starts June 14th, right? Friday, June 14th, they have on Fox Sports for the UEFA Cup.
Yep.
All right.
The Euros. Germany against Scotland. We start that. And then days later, the Copa America, which is happening here in the United States, starts. So when you're over there watching the Euros, you want big stars? You got them. Cristiano Ronaldo with Portugal. Kylian Mbappe with France.
Harry Kane with England.
Who just changed that. Now he's going to Real Madrid.
25 years old.
Yeah, Harry Kane and Jude Bellingham when it comes to England. Is it coming home for England? Is this the final dance when it comes to Cristiano with this Portugal team? Or is he looking also to 2026?
Can I just stop you there? He wasn't playing. Didn't he have a coach bench him?
Yeah.
And then he played the last game, and then he goes over to Saudi Arabia. So do you know the answer to that? What is left of his game?
I still think he can be used in a way that is beneficial. I know he does, but it's like any big-time player that does not want to stop. I don't think he necessarily has to stop, but that dynamic is going to be really interesting. They have a new coach and how you navigate that. And, you know, this is a huge ego. This is arguably one of the greatest players. Not arguably. He is one of the greatest players ever to play the game. Arguably the greatest player of the game. But he's at a point where if he is not your best option up top, you got to go and tell Cristiano Ronaldo, no, you're not playing, and then deal with the possible backlash that's coming.
Is there a chance that he would play, instead of being the striker highest up, play back a little? And somebody who's more lethal?
It's a good question. And actually is a question that's very prevalent often with aging stars that maybe don't have the same physical capacity that they had when they were younger in their career, but still mentally very tuned in, still have that like that fine art of being able to finish and find a way. Argentina did it better than anybody with Messi in the World Cup in 2022. You know, everyone was like, oh, you can't defend in this way and you need to do this. And they just said, hey, Messi, you hang out. He walks about 75% of the game. He doesn't run. But when the ball is there in the dangerous position, this guy sprints, he boom, gets on the end of it and finishes the ball in the back of the net. And they found a way to defend with basically 10 guys and said, you don't have to do it. We don't need you to do that. The challenge for Ronaldo is there's a little bit more ego there than there is with Messi. And he was pushing back with his coach and still feels he could do, because you look at the guy, he looks like he's 21 years old. You know what I mean? He's shredded. He's one of the best athletes of all time. But yet, if they can find a way to not have to ask him to do all that stuff, but still have the guys around him, which they do. They have an amazing team. He scored 10 goals in qualifying still for Portugal.
And he lit it up in Saudi Arabia. Yeah. I mean, I can say what you want about Saudi Arabia in terms of the level and all that kind of stuff, but he's still doing the most difficult thing to do in the game, which is put the ball in the back of the net.
Right, and with players that aren't close to his level.
Yeah.
Which can get frustrating.
It can get frustrating.
And I guess I saw some video of him, people getting in fights with him and things like that.
Sounds about right for him. Right. Yeah.
All right. So I didn't mean to stop you.
No. So then we segue right into later on in the day when we're talking about Copa America and this tournament that is happening here. And you got your Messi right in his backyard playing with Argentina. By the way, the defending champs when it comes to Copa America, and the first time we are seeing him in a competitive tournament since winning the World Cup and checking that box. You got Brazil with Vinny Jr. and everything that's going on there. And then, of course, you have the U.S. team, which we can talk about forever, but a really important summer for Greg Berhalter, the coach, yeah, and this team that is now kind of matured in front of our eyes, but is, I think, desperate and really needs a kind of seminal moment to point to, especially relative to doing well in 2026. And this summer, they're going to be up against it, because this is about winning a men's World Cup, ultimately. In order to do that, you have to be competitive and beat the best in the world, in the elites in the world, and teams that people say are better than you. And this team, in its current form, as deep as it is and as talented it is, has yet to do that.
I think when you played, I think I did cover you winning the Copa America.
We played in the Copa America in 1995. We went to the semifinal. So we actually,
that was the semifinal?
This is the fourth time the U.S. team has been involved in Copa America, and the second time we're hosting it. We've been to the semifinals twice. So people ask me, can you win Copa America this summer? This U.S. team absolutely can win Copa America this summer. They're going to need a lot to go right, but this is the type of raised expectations that we need. You need to believe after this summer that this team is worth your time, whether you're into soccer or not, because 2026 is coming in a couple of years, and it's going to be unlike anything has ever seen. It's going to be wonderful, and you want to have a team that you believe can compete and can win in 2026.
Let me just piggyback off of him quickly, because we had this conversation earlier. American sports fans, right? We're used to seeing and feeling excellence. We're the best in football in the world. You know, baseball, basketball. Like, we're used to being the best of the best. On the women's side, we are the best. Well, we weren't this last one. We lost to Spain. But we haven't had a moment where we have watched our men's team compete against the Brazils and Argentinas and Englands and said, hey, we can be on that level. That's what I want to be inspired by this summer, and know that we're further along that path. You've covered soccer for a long time. You know that. You haven't really felt that. Maybe if we beat Brazil and we beat Argentina and we win the Copa America, people will start thinking about 26 in a different way.
Right. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about the American team and also the emergence of Carly Lloyd as a broadcaster. Fantastic, right?
Are you? Yeah. Jersey.
Back in a moment.
You're with Brian Kilmeade. From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
All right, so we see who's here. If you're watching at home, looking on your app, Fox Nation app, Stu Holden's here, and Alexi Lalas is here. They're working together to tell us about two cups that have come to America, the UEFA Cup, the Europeans are going to fight it out, and the Copa Cup, right? So we're going to talk about what's going to be happening here. We left off with America. First off, could you give me the top five teams in Europe to look for? Just in any way, and to give me the top five teams, Stu?
Yeah. So Germany are the hosts of this tournament. They are the World Cup champions from 2014. Then the last two World Cups, they go out in the group stage. But I think there's a belief that this team could do something real being at home. France are one of my favorite teams to watch. They got to the final in 22. They won the World Cup 2018. They've got one of the best players in the world in Mbappe. England, my analogy for the English is like the Dallas Cowboys. Every single year you come into the season, they've got stars. You're thinking this team's going to win it. It's a soap opera, and then they crash out in glorious fashion. And so they're fun to watch for that. But I actually do think they have a real chance to win this tournament.
Okay.
And then Portugal is kind of my dark horse team. With Ronaldo, I know it's hard to say, but they've got super talented stacked. Betting odds, they're about plus 800, so it shows you they're not one of the top favorites, but they're a team that I think really could win this tournament.
Hey, guys, okay, go ahead.
Well, just when it comes to England, because
England, loves the English.
England is blockbuster in that everybody wants to watch them, but as many people watch them to see them lose as to see them win, so they are kind of like Dallas Cowboys. They are insufferable on and off the field, but to his point, they are stacked right now, and they are desperate for the opportunity to win a cup, to bring it home. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's coming home, but they certainly want it to come home, and that's going to be a huge story that we're following.
So here in our hemisphere, we come in, the favorite to win would be?
So you have Argentina with Messi, I think, is easy money when it comes to
reigning world champions.
Reigning world champions and the reigning Copa America champions. So Argentina and Brazil would be your upper echelon. Then you get into your Colombias and your Uruguays. And I would even put the U.S. The U.S. there in that second tier. The U.S. certainly can win this tournament. I think it's going to be really one of the big stories, obviously, is Messi, as he always is. But now in his backyard, now in his neighborhood, playing with Inter Miami. And it's the first time that we are seeing him since they won the World Cup in terms of a competitive environment and a competitive tournament. And is it a prelude to 2026 when, again, in his backyard, he could be defending his World Cup? So it's pretty
Mexico,
amazing
and the
times.
US.
Yes,
and sharing
Mexico,
the whole thing.
Yep.
And you guys
got
to be covering all on Fox Sports 1 and the network. Now, for the American team, how many players off the top of your head do you know are playing competitively overseas?
It's the majority of the roster now. Yep. So there's every single cycle, there's less and less MLS players that are a part of that. Now, it's not to say that when we're talking about players that are playing in Europe in the top leagues, a lot of them started their career here in the United States, and then they make the jump where the level is better. Look, I mean, the Premier League, La Liga in Spain, the German League, like these are superior leagues to the United States right now, and that's why these players are over there and playing, and you can see their levels are raised as well.
Yeah.
It's also raised the level of our team that these guys are playing in the biggest games now in the biggest leagues and the biggest clubs. You name a league, we've probably got an American guy playing over there, and it's an exciting time for the team. But the thing is, these guys have been doing it for their clubs. It's time for them now to step up and do it with the national
team. So Pulisic, he seems to have done really well in Italy.
Yeah.
Seems to have gotten people's respect. Do you think at the point from what you've seen from the practices and some friendlies where they're looking to make the next step?
Yeah, so when it comes to Christian Pulisic, he has grown up in front of our eyes, and he is absolutely a man now. And I love the fact that he has done so well in Italy. I love the fact that he's staying healthy. I'm going to knock on wood because that's always something we have to be concerned about. But now, as not just a player, but a leader and the expectations on his shoulders, and he doesn't have to do everything himself because he has a wonderful supporting cast, but he does need to be that star. I know he's kind of a reluctant personality and he's not over the top or anything like that, but he performs on the field. And if he takes what he is doing now and has done in Italy at AC Milan, and he's able to translate that to this national team, that's good things going forward. And like I said, a lot of other good players, Tyler Adams, Weston McKennie, who's also playing over in Italy. Gio Reyna, who I know a lot of people that maybe don't know a whole lot about soccer,
heard
about the story and the drama with his parents and all this kind of stuff, but he is an incredible talent, still relatively young, but he's got to step up too.
And this has to be your favorite interview so far.
Oh my God, this is the best.
Thank you very
much.
I wish
we love you.
I wish I didn't have to ask you to say that. I wish it came out naturally. Alexi Lalo, Stu Holden. Check out the Fox Sports lineup. Two great. You know what you're doing this summer. You're watching soccer on Fox, right?
Yeah. Absolutely.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.